Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, Paul. So, how goes life at OC Talk Radio these days?
Well, we're at our new digs at the UCI Applied Innovation Center, and so far we're applying everything we've got to make these shows better here.
And so, what does it take to make a show better?
Well, first of all,
that's a whole podcast, I understand.
That's a whole podcast. First of all, I have to get all the wires working right. That's the hardest part.
And you've been at it for a month,
oh,
bro.
I know. I think I got another month to go.
Oh, gee. The hamster cage. So, you know, Paul, today our guest brings with her a huge potpourri of emotional tragedy, cosmic learning, and even a taste of laughter. And it's really a surprising taste of laughter, because after Soheila Adelapour tells her story, I guarantee the listeners will be unsure exactly how to respond. The one thing you will certainly walk away with is a renewed vision of the miraculous power of love. In 1979, Soheila Adelapour and her family arrived in the United States after escaping the horrors of revolution and persecution in Iran. She and her five siblings stuck closely together, worked hard, married, had children, and were blessed with impressive success in New York City. Her brother, as a matter of fact, and her soulmate, went on to become a highly regarded neurosurgeon at the Lenox Hospital in Manhattan. For Soheila, however, all that changed in 2007. Her 22-year-old son, Stefan, near graduation at Boston University, was killed in a dorm room fire. The worst thing that could happen to any parent. And then only 7 years later, in 2013, her sister died after five brain surgeries. And if that weren't enough, only a few months after that, her beloved brother, which was her soulmate, died eventually of leukemia after several other difficulties. Now, for many of us, these horrible tragedies would be utterly debilitating. But as Soheila expresses in her 5-star Amazon book, Dancing to the Darkest Light, she speaks of the image or the power of love, even at the darkest of times. Now, it's enough of my talking. Let's leave the remainder in the hands of Soheila Adelapour and let her surprise us with an inspiring message of the power of love. Soheila, welcome to the next chapter, Charlie.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you for pronouncing my name so perfectly. Usually that doesn't happen. I was actually very surprised you pronounced it perfectly. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
I've been practicing.
Doesn't come easy.
Not really. It's not a difficult name, and it's so good to have an opportunity to chat with you. Now, you know, I don't know if the listeners need to know, but this is the second time we've done the podcast, because the first time we did it remotely, and I had a microphone in my home office, and being the technically illiterate person I am, I did not have it set up properly, so this is a second go-round. So this is going to be even more interesting, because I have further interesting questions to talk to you about. And I'm truly interested in this conversation, because you do have a profoundly impacting story. Now, so Halen, our last conversation, you told me that you wrote a book, Dancing with the Darkness of Light, Dancing to the Darkest Light, not Dancing to the Darkest of Light, to light, blah, 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 Dancing to the Darkest Light. Tell me, what prompted you to write that book?
To make a long story actually short, when my brother was in the hospital, he went through so many ups and downs, so many miracles and disappointments that the doctors could not believe at Mount Sinai Hospital that these things have happened. And I kept on telling my brother that, you know, we should write a book when you go home. And he said, yeah, when I go home, we're going to write a book together. because the what he went through never has happened in the history of the medical world. And unfortunately, he never made it home. But then 6 months, so I thought the book, what kind of a book should I write? The ending is so sad. What am I going to write? And then 6 months later, I was in Rome, and I was having dinner with I'm Jewish. At one of the high holidays, I was having dinner at.
Wait a minute. I'm going to have to stop you right there.
Yeah.
You're Jewish.
Yes.
But you're from Iran. Now you've got to help me here because I thought Iran was Muslim.
Iran is a Muslim country, but the history of Jews go back to Esther and Mordechai, which is more than 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, from the biblical book Esther.
They have a long history back in Iran. Long, long history back in Iran. There may be 10,000 Jews left. Most of them have left the country because they thought Khomeini is going to kill the Jews just like Hitler did. So right after Khomeini came to Iran, Jews left in like, families left one after. Most of us left everything behind because we didn't want our neighbors to know that we were leaving. So we just took our luggage, we locked the apartment, left the car, and left the country.
And you said that now, between New York and Los Angeles, there are could be 100,000 Persian Jews. Is that right?
They say so, but I don't know the exact number. But yes. Most of the Persian Jews that were living in Iran, most of them are between New York and Los Angeles. Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so...
A lot of them went to Israel as well. A lot of them migrated to Israel because they could not get a visa to come to the United States because of 444 days of the hostage crisis in Iran. The consulate in Iran did not exist anymore, so getting a visa was impossible, so they had to migrate to other countries.
Oh, I see.
And through them to come to the United States. Yes. It's all in the book, yeah.
Okay, so that explains how you are of Jewish heritage from Iran. Now, you were invited to attend a High Holy Holiday or a High Holy Religious Day of Seder, and you have a very interesting story of your experience at the Seder that I think really not only leads to the book, but it gives us an idea of the entire experience that you went through.
Yeah. I was sitting at the dinner table, and it was about 6 months after I have lost my brother. And the person next to me, we've met for the first time, the Italian gentleman, he asked me to say the prayers for the Seder that night. And I kept on saying, no, thank you. You know, I declined. And he said, why not? And I said, it's a long story. And, you know, God and I, we don't have such a good relationship now. I have been trying to contact him and tell him, can you hear me now? Obviously, he couldn't hear me, or he ignored me. And he kept on asking me, what's the story? And I said, it's not the place to talk about it. It's a sad story. And he insisted. So finally, I said, you know, last year I lost my sister and my brother in a matter of 8 months to horrible, horrible, horrible death. And I did not mention my son. And he looked at me and he continued on eating. He took a sip of his wine and then he looked at me and he said, I understand that it's very hard to lose a sibling or two, but you're going to survive that. I promise you, you're going to survive that. However, I heard that when you lose a child, life is never the same after that. So I looked at him and I said, by the way, I lost a 22-year-old son in a fire accident in Boston as well. And right there and then, when I saw the look of horror on his face and the way his eyes were shocked, I realized right there, honestly, right there, I realized that my story is a horror story. I mean, my story is what people wouldn't even probably have in their worst nightmares. So, and he didn't speak to me for the rest of the night. And after that, it made me think that, you know, I should turn around this story. I should change my story. I don't want this to be my story for the rest of my life. It's like, my story is like color blue. It's blue. But if I make an effort and add a little bit of a yellow, the color of life, the color of sun, it has no choice but to turn into green. So when people look at it, they don't see the blue anymore. They see green. The blue is still part of that color combination, but they can't see blue. So there I decided, you know something, I have my story has to have something positive coming out of it. I have to write the book for people that are going through challenges. God forbid, nothing close to mine, but any kind of challenge, any kind of difficulty. Maybe if they listen to my story, maybe if they read, especially the last chapter, Dancing with Life, they're going to, you know, look at their life and rethink their problems and think, okay, if she has gone through what she has gone through, maybe there is a way for me to go through my problem and come out of it, you know, smelling like roses from the other side.
So you wrote this book as an inspiration for other people who have gone through tragic circumstances and have ended up sort of identifying their life by their tragedy, by their circumstances, rather than by identifying their life by what has happened rather than what could be and what potential was. And you certainly looked toward, as you and I have chatted, you realized that you wouldn't let your life be defined by these tragic circumstances. Talk to me about that.
I tried very hard, especially, you know, you've heard the quote, if you have a why to live for, you will deal with any house. I have three other sons that I had to be there for it, and I wanted them to look at me and, you know, see that I'm not crumbling there. I'm not dying there. I'm not going through the process of death because of all the tragedies. I had to be strong for them. So as a result of waking up every morning and trying to be strong for them, it helped me moving forward and continue on living for them, because I wanted to live for the wives that I still had. And I didn't want them to look at me as this victim of the circumstances or what the universe has brought up to me or whatever. It's an unknowable. We never know how life works. We never know what the stories are. We don't know what life has in store for us. Whatever it is, that's not what I want to find out. What I want to know is to go how to go about my life with everything that has happened and still see beauty in it. And I wake up in the morning and I still have a goal that I think that if my book or my speeches can help a handful of people to rethink and reevaluate their problems or their challenges, then I have added the color yellow to the blue and I have changed it into green, because those tragedies are not defining me anymore. Me helping other people is what's defining me and what gives courage and color to my life.
So there's
that's
a
what my goal is.
Yes, and it's so admirable. There is a sense in you that I gather from you that there's a sense of with that inspiration comes sacrifice, and that there is, it seems, if I can maybe go through this thought process, that there is at first a sacrifice, that you are sacrificing your needs, your pains, your desires for what is good for those that you love and you have responsibility to. And that you take that responsibility seriously, you take that love seriously, and in doing so, that seemed to transform your pain into something useful or helpful, not taking away your pain, but that it transforms it into something useful and helpful. Does that resonate with you at all?
Yes. It's exactly what I tell my friends. Losing a child, life is never the same. I don't care what whoever said wants to say whatever. When they say time will heal, time will never heal. I mean, I have the picture of my son as I'm speaking to you in front of me, smiling at me, and it's like a dagger in my heart as I'm sitting behind my desk, his picture, and my brother and my sister was right in front of me. However, you know, losing a child is like losing a leg. Every morning that you wake up, as soon as you want to get out of the bed, you realize that you cannot walk like before. Life is not the same as before. You're losing one leg. So at the beginning, you have a problem getting out of bed, continuing with your everyday life. You want to do the same things that you were doing before, but you can't, however you try. Time does not heal. What time does is that it will teach you how to make the other leg strong enough, or how to use a wooden stick to help you walk and go about your everyday life like before. And you learn new tricks to continue on living. However, still, every morning that you wake up, as soon as you want to get out of bed, you realize that one leg is missing. Just that time helps you find new ways of dealing with it.
You know, I read in my inspirational readings in the mornings that I journal by, I read a very, very interesting thought that has never occurred to me before, but in all relationships, whether they are relationships, human relationships with family, with friends, with anybody, as well as if we happen to have divine relationships, there are really three relationships that are going on, and I have never, ever thought of three relationships. Like Paul and I are friends. You and I are becoming friends, but Paul and I are friends. Well, there's a relationship, my relationship to Paul, Paul's relationship to me. What this author pointed out is there's a third relationship. There is an entity, there is this existence of this thing that is bigger than Paul and I, and that it is the existence, it is the relationship in itself. It's not my relationship to Paul, neither is it his relationship to me, but our sort of essential relationship. And if Paul and I were, one of us were to die, that part of the relationship would die. But the essence of that essential relationship, what that meant between the two of us, the value between the two of us is eternal. That never goes away. Yeah. And so that explains to me how you say with your son and with your siblings, the powerful relationships that you have, while the interpersonal relationship may have ended, this third relationship never, ever goes away. That was a powerful thought. When I explained it to my wife didn't quite get it. So I don't know, is that too esoteric or does that make sense?
And I have to say it's a double-edged sword, they call it, because sometimes you don't want it to be so strong, that what still stays from that relationship, because it's like it's a table that one leg is missing, but the table is still there, and whatever you want to put on the table, you have to balance it somehow. I think that's how, because the table is still there. The thing that was there to be used and everyday use, and it's still there. It's just that, as you said, one person is the major one part of it is missing, that you think is just one leg. But once the leg is gone, the table, balancing the table, is still for me. And I'm talking from my experience. I'm not saying it is for you like that. But for me, it is a challenge every day, because as you said, the essence of that relationship is still with me every day. But it's hurtful. It hurts.
Yes.
It hurts because it's there, but it's not there.
You know, that metaphor of the table, so Hala, that's the first time I've heard you say that. That's an excellent metaphor. That really does work, that you have to balance what you put on that table, and there is something missing that the table would overturn if you put too much on that empty leg. But if you balance it out on the other, the table still serves the function that it needs to function. That's a brilliant analogy that really is good.
Thank you.
So, you know, it seems to me that you have discovered how to transform the most horrendous of human pain, and you've transformed that into inspiration and love. As we have talked, those are big ideas with you. Can you tell me, how did your three children and your other family members that are very close to you, is their role in drawing you out of pain and into this sacrificial and what turned out to be ever-fulfilling love? Well, how did your children and family members draw that out of you?
My children were very grateful when they saw the next day, the Thanksgiving weekend. I lost my brother on Thanksgiving weekend, which to him was the most important day of the year, more important than any religious holiday, because he was so proud to be an American and to be in this country. To him, it was a holy day through and through. And he happened to die on that weekend. And the day after, my sisters, my mother, they were all in the room under the blanket. None of them left their room or their apartment, none of them. And I woke up in the morning and I swear to universe, because I don't know if there's a God or not.
Sure.
That I called my kids and I told them, you know, it's Thanksgiving weekend. I heard Saks Fifth Avenue has great sales. So let's go shopping and then go have lunch on Madison Avenue. And my kids thought that I have gone crazy. But we did. We did go to Saks and we did shop the day after, because he passed on Friday night. And for Jews, Saturday is a holy day. We're not allowed to do anything. We're not allowed to bury or do anything about whatever.
It is Sabbath.
So Saturday,
yes,
was the day that we just had to wait until it comes Sunday, so we go to the burial. And we did shop, and we did go to lunch afterwards, and we talked about my brother. We talked about Stefan, my son. We talked about my sister. We talked about how cruel life could be, and it's fair, it's not fair, life is fair, about everything. And they were so appreciative that they thought they had lost me. Because during 8 months of hospital stay for my brother, I was his 100% match when he had leukemia. So I had given him two bone marrows, which he was cancer-free. And we celebrated so much at the hospital because he came out of the woods. But a week after, his liver stopped functioning because of the situation called GVH, graft versus host disease. But usually it's something small when you give a new cell into a foreign body. And in his case, the worst has happened. It was his liver that stopped functioning and turned yellow and yellow. And they told us that his bilirubin, instead of being zero, was 56. And the doctors told us that he's going to die in 5-6 days. And just in a matter of conversation, I said, you know, the only way for him to survive is for you to give part of your liver to him. And I said, how do I give my liver? My liver is just, it's not a kidney. And they said, no, they can take 60% of your liver and give it to your brother, but we're not going to do that because he's dying anyway. And you're a healthy woman with young children. We're not going to put you in jeopardy because you could die. Make the long story short, I started begging and begging and begging, and finally they agreed to do it on Friday. On Friday, we went under surgery. Obviously, I didn't die. And he survived as well. So this is one of the miracles that happened. And it was the first leukemia patient that survived bone marrow transplant and that was given the liver of the same donor, and he survived that too. First ever. A lot of things have happened. So I had invested a lot in my brother's sickness, which my sisters, because they were not a match, they didn't invest so much. So my kids, my boys, thought for sure after my brother died from pneumonia in the hospital, they thought that I'm done with, I'm finished. But I had to prove to them that I'm not. So that's why I told them, listen, life goes on. We move forward. I did whatever humanly possible I could do for my brother. I did. And from now on, life is about the living, you guys. Because bygones are bygones. He's gone. There's nothing I could do now. Whatever I could do, I did in 8 months. From here on, it's about you guys and people that I love.
So, you know that's such an amazing attitude that it is so counterintuitive, yes. And yet it is contra human nature that we are so overwhelmed by pain and think we are so familiar with it that we tend to let it take over, and you just refused. What type of character do you have that helped you to do that? That so many people don't have that character.
I've been told I'm strong, but I don't think I'm strong. I just think, as you said 15 minutes ago, I don't want to be identified by these things. And I think it is, I always thought it is what it is, so what's next? But if I can tell the audience about the Mona Lisa story that we discussed.
I really want to hear the Mona Lisa story, but I think before we hear that story, it is time for us to take a break, and then I will get right into your Mona Lisa syndrome. Hi, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie. And my very special guest today is Sohaila Adelapour, and who has experienced extreme tragedy, still suffers the pain of that tragedy, but has been able to transform that pain into a light and into love and into inspiration. And my question to her was, where did she find the wherewithal to do that? And she wants to tell us a story of something she calls the Mona Lisa syndrome that is a powerful story. So Hala, please tell us that story.
Thank you. So I read somewhere that Mona Lisa, the painting, was stolen in 1911 from the Louvre. Basically, what happened was an Italian worker that was mopping the floor looked at the Mona Lisa, and he thought, it's an Italian masterpiece. What is it doing at the Louvre? So he just decided to pick the painting, put it under his robe and on a piece of fabric, wrap it, and take it home. So for the 2.5 years that the painting was missing at the Louvre, more people came to the museum to look at the bare wall and shake their head in regret than all those years previous to that date that the Mona Lisa was hanging there. It is the power of remorse. It's the power of what if, visualizing what if that thing would still be here. How beautiful life this museum would be if Mona Lisa was still hanging over here. Well, the rest of the story is that he was hiding it in his apartment, and finally they found it after 2.5 years because he told one of his friends that he's hiding it, and they brought it back to the museum. But how I look at life is exactly when I call it the Mona Lisa story, is that I realize that every morning that I wake up, that my masterpiece was taken away from me at an early age. But if I make an effort, if I turn around a little bit, there are still walls around me with other masterpieces that are hanging on them. I don't want to waste my life staring at the bare wall and shaking my head in regret while I still have valuable masterpieces hanging on the rest of the walls. So every morning that I wake up, I notice that there's a bare wall in front of me. And of course, it makes me sad. But I'm not fixated. I'm not stuck on that wall, on that bare wall. I make an effort. I realize that I just have to turn around to notice the rest of the masterpieces, which are the rest of my kids, my family, and my friends. Because, you know, God forbid, when I lost my son, I never knew after a few years I'm going to lose my sister and my brother. There were masterpieces too, so I should appreciate those masterpieces that are hanging on the wall versus just stare at the bare wall. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to be present to give love and receive love from the people that are still, the loved ones that are still around me. That is, I don't want to be staring at the bare wall.
That is such a beautiful, beautiful story. And, you know, it reminds me of, you know, the common statement. And I think there are several songs that say, we don't know what we have until it's gone. And then there's this tendency to focus on what is gone rather than to do what you have done, and that is to, the verb I'm using is to transform it, to find out what other masterpieces can be put on that wall that doesn't take away the loss, the love, the pain of what is gone, but it fulfills it with new responsibility and new accountabilities and new places to find, discover, and to distribute love. And I think you have done that, and that is such, you know, Sohaila, that is so inspirational to us, and I think it deals with so many areas of life, you know, certainly death and loss, but so many areas of loss, and our loss of careers, and our loss of relationships, and our loss of ego, and our loss of possessions, is that we have this tendency to bemoan those and not to replace them or transform them or find areas where we can distribute this fountain of love that we have inside of us, that when we access that is inexhaustible, that it is always there. It just sometimes gets dammed up, you know, like a herd of beavers, whatever you call them, damming up the dam of love, and we need to undo that dam and let that love pour out once again, and it changes our life.
Yeah. The thing is that I realize the value of life now more than ever because of, you know, it was difficult when we lost our home and our money and we had to start from zero in a country that my parents didn't know any English. I mean, I spoke English, but they didn't know any English and they had to start from zero. I had to do babysitting. We all had to, you know, save some money here and there to be able to survive. And it was the land of opportunity. It is the land of opportunity when people say it. And we did make it in this land of opportunity. But at this moment, the money comes and goes, but you cannot say that about loved ones. Once they're gone, they're gone. You miss them for the rest of your life. But I want to be present for everybody else and everything else that's around me, all the blessings. I know it sounds like cliche, but it's true. Again, when I lost my son, I never thought I'm going to lose my sister, my brother. My brother, you know, as he was in the hospital, I kept on telling him, you know, I love you as much as I love any of my boys. You know that, right? You know that, right? That's how much I love my brother. I learned to be present, and I realized that the present becomes past every moment, and past is no more, and future is not yet. So why, between the two, that they don't exist, you have no other choice but to be present. So, and I want to be here for the ones that are still here, and as long as I'm still here, and to love them and appreciate them and enjoy them and celebrate them. That's what my plan is.
What an inspiring story. You know, I read poetry a bit, and one of the most renowned poets, T.S. Eliot, in a volume of poetry that he wrote, The Four Quartets, he writes repeatedly about beginnings, about endings and beginnings. And he writes in life, the sort of the model of life is every end is the beginning of something else. That's an easy take in some situations, but in your situation, that's a real hard pill to swallow, that this end
that's
is a,
funny
is a beginning.
Yeah, that's funny that you said that. Sorry for interrupting you. But I always say, I never put it that word because I'm not a poet, obviously. I always say an exit from the other side is an entrance.
Yes.
Every exit, every door, every highway exit, anywhere that you exit, hallway, there's an entrance on the other side. If it's not an entrance on the other side, then it's not an exit, then there's a wall. If you cannot exit something, you cannot enter anywhere else. So it is true. you said it in a very poetic way. When, you know, the ending, which is the exit, is the start of a new thing. And I look at life the same way, actually. I think when we came to this world, we exit our mom's womb and we enter this life, which, you know, to 9 months of staying in that dark place, it looks like the end of the world to come to this chaotic, lit, full of light, full of noise. But then it's a new start here. And it's unknowable that where are we going to go from here? Because we're exiting this world. Nobody knows. Nobody has gone with a yellow pad and notes, take notes and come back.
Yes.
You know, this is what the same way we cannot go back to our mom's womb and tell if there was a twin. Listen, outside there's color, there's smell, there's light. There is no such a thing. We cannot go back. And I always said it, that every exit is an entrance on the other side. And thank you for saying it so beautifully, Charlie.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm glad that works with you. You know, what I'd like to do is we're beginning to wrap up our session now I would like to talk about some of the steps you took, and there's a couple of things that you have mentioned. I've read and we've chatted, and you believe part of that transition to inspiration and love doesn't happen naturally. It takes a conscious effort. It is a conscious choice that you make. You have a choice to stay in the loss or to view this as a beginning. And I want to continually reiterate, that does not mean you ignore the loss, deny the loss. The loss is part of you. The loss is a new opportunity for you and for you to love in a whole different way without ceasing to love that which is past. But you talk about conscious choices, I would love for you to tell me, you know, what kind of processes have you used to make that conscious choice to love in spite of despair?
Never sat down, Charlie, I'm sorry to disappoint you and the audience, I mean, people that are listening. I never sat down and thought about deciding to have this choice. I didn't see any other choice but to go on and make the best of what's left. I honestly thought I have to, in order to change my life, I have to change my point of view, which is given. I'm not saying that everybody else does that too. It's not my phrase. The key thing over here is to change. And, you know, as the Greek philosopher said, you can never step into the same river twice because it's not the same river and you're not the same person. The world is changing. Every day is changing. And so to be stuck in the same frame of mind when it doesn't work anymore, like if I wanted to just sit home and think of the losses that I had, the tragic losses that I had, that would be death for me.
I'm just existing.
I'm not living anymore. So I never sat down and I thought about it. I just did it, as Nike says, and I always say, I think the biggest philosopher in the world is Nike because he says, just do it. I just did it. And honestly, I always tell my kids, between Nike and between Dory in Finding Nemo, says, just keep on swimming. And Nike says, just do it. If you just follow these two small phrases, you're okay in life.
What about the people, Sohaila, that it requires such an effort because they are so distraught and so, they're just so overwhelmed by this loss? Do you have words for people that have become overwhelmed and lost and just almost immobilized? How do you inspire or encourage people in that position?
First of all, I tell, unfortunately, people that lose their loved ones, I always tell them that you have to take your time and to grieve and not to rush to come out of it if that's what you need to do. If I take a machete and I cut off somebody's arm, I cannot tell the person, keep on telling the person, well, calm down, calm down. You know, you shouldn't be screaming, calm down. No, it has the time, it has to go by so the pain is not as bad as when I cut off the arm. It has to be less pain in order for that person to be able to listen to what I have to say to him or her. It's for every person, for each person, it's different, I think. I personally looked at my other children, and as I have told you before, I thought they deserve better than this, to have a mother that's broken. They deserve a better life than this. And I decided right there and then to change, because change is a small word. I know it's a small word, and it's not a fancy word, but a small keys open huge doors, and change is one of those small keys. The person cannot go on living with the same attitude and the same frame of mind. You have to change your point of view. You have to change the way you thought about life and put your emphasis on the rest of the masterpieces. Again, going back to that story, the rest of the masterpieces that you own around you. Or find another way of finding a purpose for your life. The life doesn't, I mean, if you're waiting for God to show you the purpose of your life, it's not going to. God is not. Listen, and a lot of dictators thought, they're saying that God, it's God's message to them to kill all these people because it's the purpose of their life. No, God doesn't do that. You find the purpose of your life. You find how to go about this and how to find meaning, as Viktor Frankl says in his famous book, how to find meaning. And
I
live
agree.
For the whys in your life and not the why nots.
That's
emphasis is to live for the whys in your life and not the why nots. Because it
the
is
whys
what
and the
it
hows.
Is.
Yeah.
The unfortunate and the tragedy has happened. Yeah. You don't want to make that tragedy a worse tragedy by ignoring the rest of the loved ones that are around you and damaging them for the rest of their life. They're damaged enough.
You know what I'd like to do now is I would like to have my final question for you, and that is, without rehearsing the entire chapter, I would like you to just give me the couple of high points, and that you have emphasized a few times in writing and in chatting that the closing chapter of your book, which is titled Dancing with Life. Is especially meaningful for you. Why is that?
Because I believe that life, living in this world, is like, you know, that, because I like dance. I like to dance. Music changes my mood 100%. And I think life plays different kind of music. It plays sad music. It plays happy music. It plays rock and roll. It plays, you know, all sorts of music. And you have to play to that tune in order for your life to have some synchronicity with the world that you're living in, with the life that you've been given. Otherwise, if somebody's playing a waltz and you play and you dance jive, it sounds ridiculous, and you're going to be exhausted at the end because they do not go together. I named it Dancing with Life because I think that when things are going well for people, nobody says, oh, why me? Why am I so lucky to have this? Or why am I so lucky that I'm living this life? Nobody says that. But as soon as something goes wrong, and we're not talking about extreme tragedies like mine, problems, challenges, then everybody starts questioning, why me? Why couldn't it be this way? We all want change, but we all want changes that we asked for. We don't want changes that we didn't ask for, but life does not listen to you. Life plays its own music. And the way to go along with it and not to be exhausted, frustrated, or angry is to just move to the vibration of that music. It's like you're going down the river and you constantly want to hold on to a piece of a branch that the waves are taking you, the current is taking you, but you're holding on to that branch. And I want to know, how long can you hold on to that branch? At the end, a few hours, you're going to be exhausted and tired beyond imagination. It is much better to let go and then just float over the waves and go along with the waves, because you never know where it's gonna, where you're gonna end. Maybe you end up in a beautiful, calm water at the end. Usually you do. Usually rivers end up somewhere calm. And you like the scenery, even though you're tired, even though you have been hit by rocks here and there. But maybe that ride, if you let go, if you let go and trust life, maybe life will take you somewhere that it's not so bad after all. Instead of saying, why me, or why couldn't be this way, or why couldn't be the other way, just trust life and go on with it. I understand that life could be cruel, but nobody promised us a happily ever after ending. It's just in the fairy tales, and it's going to stay in fairy tales. There is never happily ever after story. Yeah, there is no such a thing. It's always in fairy tales, and we don't expect it in our everyday life. There is no such a thing.
I love the idea of dancing with life, and you know, I have to, you know, we are so similar. We resonate in so many places with life and with the approach of life. And the only place that, you know, is slightly different is that, you know, I happen to see, and it's just, you know, my paradigm, I happen to see the influence of God in life. And I believe relationship with God is in a book titled by a man that I really like, and it's called The Divine Dance. And that is what we are doing, is that we are dancing with God. Just as you say, dancing with life, it is a dance with the divine, and this dance of give and take, and of both contributing and both responding and both serving one another. And that is the way you view life. And it seems to me that is the way you view life. And I so appreciate that. So Hela Adilapour, I really so appreciate you and the value that you bring to this show. And I will have in the podcast notes, and I recommend strongly, Dancing in the Darkest Light.
Dancing
I know.
To the darkest light.
And
if I may say one thing, just to clarify one thing, Charlie, when I said I'm not so sure if I can believe in God, of course there's a God, but my God is the God that lives in nature. And when I see nature and its grandeur and its beauty, a sunrise and a sunset, I know there's a God. When I say I do not believe in a God that's by organized religion, 100% there's a divine force, 100% there's something out there that we cannot comprehend because it's unknowable. But my God is when I hug a 500-year-old tree, because the mosque or synagogue or a church could be built with money and power, but that tree cannot be rebuilt by anybody but the divine force.
Beautifully,
so to me, that's God.
Beautifully put, and I so concur that I think institutional religion has done as much damage to the divine as anything. And you know, while it's done great good, there's been great good, but there's been tremendous as we go through history, tremendous trouble. But you know, and also,
I just have
you know,
to clarify that. Sorry.
Yeah, and you will because there is an entity outside of us that is obviously a spark within you, and that divine spark is lighting to the degree that the divine chooses to light it, and you are responding, obviously responding, with goodness and compassion and care and love. You're a magnificent human being. So Adilapour,
I'm humbled. In my book, again, Dancing to the Darkest Light, at the end there's an email. So I would love to hear from people that read the book or they want to get in touch with me. There's an email address at the end of the book that I would love to hear from whoever that wants to. Yeah.
After the show,
after we're done with the show,
we'll put those on the show notes. You know, I have your website and I have the link to the book, but I know you have
a foundation you'd
like me to put a link to, and I'll get your email. I have your email. You want me to just use your regular email?
No, no, because that's not for the book. The email for the book, I have to give it to you.
Give that to me. Thank you once again for this tremendous show. And as always, I want to thank our listeners for tuning in to The Next Chapter with Charlie. And be sure to check us out at our website, thenextchapter.life. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.
Thank you. Thank you.